Late breaking story on the CBC. A nation whispers we always knew that he'd go free. They add you can't be fond of living in the past. If you are, then there's no way that you're gonna last. We kings and pretty things. Let's just see what tomorrow brings.
Live now?
Yes. Hello, hello. Welcome to Call Me Negotiator. And this is a show dedicated to the art of negotiation, the East meets West conversation, and how individuals navigate complex power dynamics across nations and industries. These insights are essential for anyone navigating international trade, cross-border collaborations, and global entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Charlotte. My perspective is grounded in my background studying law in Chengdu, China, and negotiation at Columbia University in New York. I am currently specializing in AI-enhanced negotiation training at the Ivis Lab at SFU in Vancouver. We are live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Pacific time. If you are in Vancouver, you can tune your radio to CJSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby Mountain, or simply head over to cjsf.ca and click Listen Live to join us from anywhere in the world. Joining me today is Mr. Shahla, and he is the local Canadian as a First Nation. I don't fully know his story, but I know that he did a lot of cool things, so let's get started. And with his story, I'm very excited. Hi, Shahla.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I just want to know that, How can I perfectly or correctly pronounce your name?
Oh, it's from the Ntlakemc tribe up in the Nicola Valley, from the Ntlakemc people. And to pronounce it, you say Hwaiange Shachlach. And in my language, Hwaiange, I learned after, I think I was about 35 when I finally was able to find out what it meant. And I get people asking me from time to time, what does Hwaiange mean? And I was able to track it down from my grandmother and one of my great uncles. And I was finally able to get it. And they spoke in our language for quite a while. And finally, they were able to tell me, and they said the closest that we could translate it to from our language to like English, they said it meant soft talker. And it was very interesting because before all that, I wasn't a soft talker. I was opposite.
Oh, how do you define soft talker?
Soft talker, I think it has something to do with positivity too.
Mm.
Like just the way that we communicate with each other. And it can come from our tone.
Mm.
It can come from just our mannerisms. And I did learn this because I didn't immediately turn just like automatically into a soft talker.
And, oh, right.
And to what I am now, it's been a process. It's been, I liked how you communicated with me. And you were asking me about my journey.
Mm.
And, you know, all our lives are journeys. And, you know, it's a short journey.
Right.
Sometimes it can be pretty rough, too.
Mm.
And when you were asking me about, you know, my highlights or whatever I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
It made me think of that.
So I know you from this radio station, and you've already started to host this show. And I know that you came back from a helicopter, or not helicopter, right? Not necessarily helicopter, or I know that like captain training.
Yeah,
but what kind of aircraft or a helicopter, I'm not so sure.
Right now, I'm just starting to fly the Bell 206.
Okay, I have no idea.
It's a bigger helicopter. The one that I started training on was a Cabri G2 helicopter, and it's like a two-person helicopter.
Mm.
So the cockpit is pretty small, and there's no room for passengers.
Right.
So that's how I started. And then about a month ago, I switched over to the Bell 206, which is a bigger helicopter.
Mm.
It fits five people in there.
So
two pilots and three passengers in the back. So it's bigger. I believe it's funner.
Yeah. So I think I don't meet many people that are trained to be a pilot in driving or flying helicopter, and that really amazed me. However, you told me a little bit story behind why you do this, which is to do something helping people instead of just being cool and trying new experiences. Could you share a little bit about the story and the reason why you do this?
Yeah, sure. It all started like 3 years ago. I'd say 3.5 years ago.
Right.
4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, well, I'll just say 5 years ago, we had a bunch of big forest fires in BC. And it was very tragic because It was a very, very hot summer.
Okay.
So all over BC, there was big forest fires going on and they just weren't going out. And I have a lot of family members up in the Nicola Valley and all up in BC all over, but primarily in the Nicola Valley. And so these fires came down and it was scary because, you know, I want to find out, like, are you guys safe? And I wanted to call them. And I was able to call it at first. And they said, you can't call back anymore. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, why not? And they said, well, we have to keep our lines open.
Right.
So if the fires come, then we can call or they can call us and inform us to get out.
Mm.
So, you know, it was very stressful for me to sit there thinking like, man, I just got to watch the news and hope that my family's all right and living and surviving. So all summer I was watching and waiting, and it's tough, you know, especially when your family that you grew up and love and lived with all your life are up there. And so the fires came down to the point where they were all evacuated.
Okay.
And all up and down the Fraser River, Thompson River, Nicola River, in many parts of the rest of British Columbia too, that was like burning so bad. The roads were shut down, and nobody was able to go in or out. And it was pretty tough. I had reports later on, like my sister up there was telling me, like, you know, it was so bad, especially at night, because, you know, there's all these big forest fires going on. And she said it was kind of horrifying because at night, the mountains would glow red.
Yeah, I understand that those fires can be horrible, especially we hear a lot of news about how those mountain fires, forest fires, could even burn the rich people and poor people's houses and in the properties in California. But I have no idea that it could happen here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was very serious because when they were finally evacuated, there was nowhere to go.
Yeah, so how that experience made you decide that you were going to get trained to fly?
Well, you know, it was hard enough during that time because after that, about a month or two after the fires went out, there was flooding.
Okay.
And the floods were so bad, it wiped out a lot of bridges.
Okay.
So even if I could drive up there, I wouldn't get to them because the bridges were washed away too.
Right.
So it made me feel even more helpless. And so the next year, same thing.
Mm.
More fires and more flooding. And I'm just thinking like, how the heck, what should I do?
Mm.
And then I remember because I went up and I saw my family after and many of my family and friends. And they were telling me like after a while we could only sit and watch the helicopters come and go.
I see.
And then that's what sparked me.
Right. So you felt like, oh, this fire disaster made you feel really worried about your families and friends, and you wanted to do something. You wanted to visit them.
That's right.
But then the only way you thought it was driving to there. However, the flood blocked the way.
Yeah.
And then the helicopter sort of information gave you this inspiring idea to just literally do it.
I was fortunate because when I was really young, I did get a ride in a helicopter off a mountaintop. And it made me realize like it was supposed to be like a scary trip. Like we went over a cliff and we went straight down. But it was very fun for me. I enjoyed it. I loved it. And I was screaming with happiness and just laughing, having a great time. And then later on, I realized, like, as I was thinking about it, I could easily do this. If I wanted to be a helicopter pilot, I could, because I didn't have any fear of heights or get motion sickness or anything. And that stayed with me like for, I don't know, 40 years or whatever went by. And then it hit me and I realized, well, hey, I had a ride in a helicopter and I have an experience and it was fun and I enjoyed it. And then that's when I thought, okay, maybe that's what I meant to do. Maybe that's what I should do.
Mm.
And so that's when I started to inquire about it. But I had no idea. I have no knowledge of helicopters.
Yeah. So it was just a few years ago. Could you share with us what age were you when you decided that you wanted to do and learn being helicopter pilot?
I think I was 52.
You were 52.
Yeah.
So that, I think a lot of young people, especially nowadays, they feel like, oh my God, I cannot do another thing. And especially now everybody discuss about AI, so AI probably take up the job and then they need to transfer to a new industry or area, or they need to adopt the new tools.
Mm.
And a lot of people would fall into this trap where they feel super anxious because they think they cannot learn anything new to be able to compete with other people. So obviously when you decided to fly helicopter to learn and to become a professional pilot flying helicopter, you were obviously not falling into the young people age group, but then you still were, I would say, audacious and brave to do this. Could you share with us, like, is there any special mentality that you hold, or are you just simply adopting the concept of you can learn anything?
Well, it all comes from the question that you asked me earlier, and you were asking me, you know, what are the highlights? And I would say one of the biggest highlights of my life was when I was working with Counselor Fari. And when I started working with Counselor Fari, I decided once I started working with her and realizing and seeing her status and her abilities and her importance to a lot of Indigenous people. And when I finally started working with her, and I told her right from the start, and this came from Elders Council, and Elders Council, and we would get together and talk about these important things, and the importance of this special lady, Counselor Fari, and it was decided that I would become her bodyguard.
Okay.
And I went through executive protection specialist training.
Right.
And so I went in and, man, it was tough. It's very hard training. It takes a lot of mentality and it made me using a lot of negative energy. Which I was really good at. I was full of negative energy.
Oh, interesting.
So it helped me in that direction. Like, because you got to be in a state of mind of being just always on the brink of violence.
Oh yeah, wait.
So you got to react, and you got to react violently, and be able to do a lot of bad things to bad people.
Great.
But it takes a toll on you. It takes some humanity away, if you had any. And I always say that I don't know if I even had any humanity in me.
Oh, interesting.
And because I worked with Counselor Fari, and I did it for 25 years.
Oh, okay.
So it took up quite a chunk of my life and time. But because we were like opposite, people. She was full of positivity, full of energy and humanity.
Right.
I always knew the importance of human rights and justice and stuff, and that's kind of what pulled me towards this special person, because she always spoke about that humanity and human rights and justice, and so I knew that it would be very important to keep someone like that protected and safe.
Yes.
And I noticed there was a lot of like negativity going towards that kind of mentality, believe it or not. So that's why I decided, okay, well, this person needs protection, and I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to go and get the credentials to do it. And so I did. It was pretty tough. I wouldn't say it's an easy thing to do and decide to do. It takes it isolates you.
Oh, interesting. Why? Because you're a bodyguard, so you cannot have too much connection with
others? Yeah, you almost got to sever all connection with everybody.
Okay, yeah, I see. So I now feel like I have more puzzles to make the whole map of your story more complete, where you now, hosting this show, you wanted to pass the information to other people where we have free voice. And as I constantly be the guest of your show, I realize that there's a lot of meaningful topics like connections or like empathy, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously those are the positive messages. However, you do professionally flying helicopter because you wanted to have more people and visit your friends and family when there's a disaster happen, or maybe in another time. And before you get into this, you were a bodyguard for counselor for 25 years, and that basically shaped and built who you are today.
It did. I think, as I said, we were like polar opposites, you know. She was so full of this positivity and I was like full of this,
negativity. Yeah. That's really funny.
It was strange, like, you know, how do you do that? And of course, you know, that old adage of opposites attract. So here she is on the opposite spectrum of positivity, and I'm right on the opposite spectrum of negativity.
Yeah.
So we're just like so far apart, but we were able to, over the years, I think we just started to have that very special connection, and I started realizing, seeing, like, wow, those are very beautiful qualities to have. When she would talk about her positivity and the positive energy and
right,
how to switch your energy from negative to positive, and it really interested me, and I didn't know if I could do it.
I want to ask this because I want to elaborate a little bit about the positivity and negativity, because now the world is not in the very peaceful place, and even people who live in the peaceful and safe countries like you and me in Canada or our audiences in China, let's say, still people can feel tons of negativity. A lot of people want to kill themselves. I talked to someone, they felt that way. However, they're not in the war zone, right? So which means a lot of like life experiences can bring us this negative mindset. And could you share a little bit about how, if you have ever analyzed how and why you have those negativity, and how to, like, could you make some example of why you felt like that was absolutely negativity?
Well, I believe, in my journey and travel, I came across a special brother from another mother. His name is Sagaj, and he was a part of the United States Army and the Canadian Army.
Okay.
So a veteran of both armies. But after he came out of that, he went into political science.
Oh.
Political science, okay. And he started studying like history and different things, and indigenous governance. He studied that, and he started to realize through his studies, he came across this this information that talks about the state of anime.
Okay.
And this state of anime actually comes from the conditions of genocide. And you know, it's known through history now, and we can look back not even like 35 years ago, and they had the residential schools still going here in Canada, and they were basically brainwashing Native people and kids into assimilation and destroying culture, traditions, and heritage, and even language. And this causes the state of anime. And so that was the state that I was in, which brought up so much negativity and all these thoughts of violence and stuff. And so, and you know, it basically makes you like suicidal. The end result of the state of anime is suicide, usually, in one type or form. Either it's through addiction, or it's actually through something physical, like a rope or a weapon or something. So I realized from listening to my brother Sagaj and getting a lot of information with Counselor Fari, because she was an addiction counselor, and as well as many other things too, but she dealt with a lot of Indigenous people and troubles and problems, and so that's where a lot of this negative energy was coming from, and still very present in all the Indigenous communities across North America, South America, anywhere in the world really, where there's colonialism. And so I was pretty fortunate that I got a lot of survival instincts and enough positive energy in my young life. When I was growing up, I was raised by my great grandparents, which is pretty unusual in itself. And so I used to think about it, and it used to like kind of hurt me that I was, and it almost felt like I was almost ashamed of it. And then later on, I'm thinking about it, and I'm talking with other people, and I'm reflecting and realizing, like, man, that was special that I went through that. And I received so much of their unconditional love and support. It's something that everybody that goes through that, where, you know, they grow up not in a full family unit, it's like a disconnection.
I see. So basically, as I could understand, that childhood experience can really shape build the foundation of our mindset. It could be negative or more towards to positive in the spectrum, where as a First Nation person or kid that you grew up and educated in that place where you constantly were taught to face and deal with violence and conflict, so that could make the mindset really focus on those negative status, right? One thing that I really wanted to share about the psychological part of the negativity and the positivity, because I think a lot of people misunderstood how you can say you're a negative person or you're a positive person, because this could be like, oh, then I don't want to identify myself as a negative person. So it's really hard for people to face and accept that the negative part or mindset that we have in our minds, and therefore hard to find solution to change it. So to define negativity, we can find some actually image or picture